The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, we can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So the reason I said it's nice to see you, I have been gone for a little bit over a month. I was out at our hermitage, the Compassionate Friend Hermitage, which of course I'm very grateful for, both to the monastic community here and to the lay sangha for, you know, supporting us being able to do that, because it's kind of a luxury, really, when you know, be able to spend a month alone in a nice place like that. And my time out there was primarily a retreat, although I think I did get quite a bit of rest, too. I mean, as we all know, you know, change is as good as rest sometimes. And I don't yearn to be alone, you know, to go off and practice alone by myself, but I've grown to quite appreciate it and like it. And, you know, sometimes it goes smoothly, and sometimes you're just faced with yourself, and there's suffering, but you can see through that. Okay. So what I wanted to talk about today is some reflections and thoughts that I had while I was out there. At some point while I was out there, I jotted a few things down, and then I stopped. But there are a few things that remained kind of through the time I was out there. And these are not going to be big, insightful things. Rather, they're just my observation of the way things were. Okay. Sometimes I hear people say, in to regard to the monastery, that it's different than the real world. The world many of you live in daily. I usually take exception to that, and to that way of aligning reality. No doubt I have a bias, having lived way over half my life in a monastery. So I might even go so far as to turn the real world statement on its head and say the monastery is the real world. But I'm not going to stand on my head and make that statement, because it's kind of a foolish argument, as far as I'm concerned, and that's me. I think that the real world is just where we are. You know, it's not someplace over there or over here, it's just where we are. And I think the key to living in the real world, if you want to put it that way, is to engage fully wherever you are. The real world is not one of isolation or hiding. Quite frankly, as much as you might try, you can't actually hide. You know, you can't actually live in isolation. It's not reality. It's not the real world. If we're cutting ourselves off, we're just not living as fully as we can. We're missing opportunities. So I'm going to say that the hermitage was and is the real world also, because it's another, you know, different scene. The fact is, when you're out there, you're living with nature. And, you know, there's deer and bear and... you don't tend to see the bear much or the mountain lions much, but they're there. You know, you see their droppings and other things. You're in the trees, relatively quiet, but the bugs, you know, this business about nature being really quiet and peaceful. If you sit outside, the bugs or something else. And I've heard that about the deepest jungles of Thailand or whatever, that, you know, we think it's going to be all so quiet and very, very noisy. But one of the things I noticed out there was that the three marks of existence, dukkha, anicca, anatta, so suffering, or unsatisfactoriness, impermanence, and no separate self. I could see those characteristics. I can see them here, but I could see them there. For some reason, they kind of stood out. That is, at least when we're kind of living, you know, with a presence and a mindfulness and an awareness of what's going on around us. And as I say, most of the time I could be with that quality of time. I noticed that time was always moving out there. You know, you get there in your first few days there and you think, now I got 27 more days to be here. Well, then before you know it, a week's up and 2 weeks, half my time's gone. You know, you can't stop it. You can slow yourself down, which I think is a good thing to do, but you can't stop time. Impermanence was right there. Change was right there in front of my face. In fact, it was a time when I first got there, it was going back and forth from spring to winter, and you know, when in a day you'd have sun and hail and snow and rain, and then sun again, and then it got to be 80 degrees, and then you were 60 felt like a heat wave after you went back to 30 again. So this, and you know, spring's real pretty, and the trees were budding out, the maples and the oaks, wildflowers coming up. Okay, suffering, unsatisfactoriness. I saw three fresh deer carcasses, 10-minute walk from the Hermitage, because it's wild out there, and you know, presumably, it's the mountain lions. But I did hear that bears actually killed deer, so I don't want to pin it all on the mountain lions. You know, and there's no sense burying these carcasses. I tried that once. The next day, it was completely torn up. You know, I offer merit to the being. Hope that they didn't, you know, die in awful fear, or if they did, that they can move on from that. But anyway, you go back in a few days, there's hardly anything there. So nature doesn't waste. Makes use of every little bit. Okay. And in fact, it's their real world. I mean, it's the food chain. And depending on where you are on the food chain, you're on the run. Sometimes I think we think of nature as always, kind of smooth. And I was out there one time walking up a hillside, and I heard this crashing about, and then all of a sudden this snorting of soil. It was a deer that I had, woken up, and in the process of waking up, they were as clumsy as heck. You know, they just got all this dust in their face, and so. I have always appreciated trees. I grew up in a city, but I actually grew up right next to Golden Gate Park and Sunset Boulevard, so I spent a lot of my spare time when I wasn't at a ball field somewhere in the trees, crashing about. Actually, I wanted to be a forest ranger, but I didn't get the scholarship for football from Colorado State, so there you go. Just as well. It was all just as well. I've always found, and this is from, since being small, that the forest is this much bigger thing than me. It kind of puts me in my place. And in terms of Buddhism, I think what it does is it puts you in that place of non-self. Also, it shows you it points out your interconnectedness with things. You feel part of it. There's just something about nature and people. They feel part of it. They don't feel divided from it or separate. As you know, the Buddha trained for many years in the forest, and he returned there often. He didn't spend his whole life in the forest, but he spent initially quite a bit of time there, and then he would go back for retreat. The Buddha went on retreat, I gather. you know, he wasn't beyond needing that. He also devoted 40 years of his life to teaching beings. He visited small towns, bigger, I don't know if they called them cities in those days, but whatever, bigger places, population places, to offer teaching. So as much as I like staying at the Hermitage, I don't own it. It's not me. And it actually exists for the benefit of a much larger purpose. So I can have sympathetic joy for all those that go out there. And, you know, it's just a really nice place. River Master G.U. Kennett used to talk about how in life we have to learn to go in and out. You know, she's that we don't want to get stuck or fixed in an experience or a place. We have to be able to move, because in fact that's what the three marks of existence point to, and they also point to the difficulties when we don't. So while I was out there at the Hermitage this time, and each time is different, I'm sure you experience this when you go places, you know, you go once and you have this experience, you go again and your experience is a little bit different, but for some reason this saying kept running through my head when I was out there. It was, when alone, train like you are with others, and when with others, train like you are alone. Well, when I came back from the Hermitage, I was talking with Reverend Master Mayon about this, and she actually told me where that came from. She said, there's a Chinese proverb. I tried desperately to find it on the internet last night, couldn't find it. But anyway, there's a Chinese proverb. When you are alone, behave as though you are with honored guests. And then when you are with honored guests, behave as if you are alone. So it's, you know, this juxtaposition, this seeming contradiction. So what does it mean? You know, as I say, it kept going through my head. And, you know, in thinking about it, both out there and in coming back, I think it definitely has a Buddhist context for our practice. Kind of take it from the negative here first. When you're alone, you don't need to imagine or conjure up people. I don't think that's what it's saying. You know, you don't have to conjure up a guest or have, you know, so you can have conversations and, you know, set a place for them at the dinner table and all that. No, not necessary, okay? You know, as I said earlier, when we're in the forest, I actually don't think we're alone. Sentient beings are all over the place. They're all around us. I sort of have this practice of not walking around in the dark out of the Hermitage. It's really not based on fear of what's going on out there, but I don't believe the time belongs to me. I think it belongs to all those creatures who are a little timid in the day. And if you believe in devas, as we talk about in Buddhism, they abound in the forest. You know, it's said that at the time of the Buddha, the devas would come and complain to the Buddha about what the monks were doing in the forest, what they were getting up to. And the Buddha would, you know, he'd do something. They'd be really kind of sloppy or whatever. Okay, so all kinds of sentient beings out there. Okay, when we're with honored guests, you want to say when we're with others, there's no need to become invisible. You can't do it anyway, you know. Definitely when we're with others, we don't want to act with disregard or pretend they're not there. I mean, people don't like that. You know, it's not a very good way to act. It's rude. We should pay attention to our guests. We should, in fact, pay attention to what's around us, wherever we are. So I think what this proverb points to is that we should be consistent in our practice in all circumstances. Okay? And that we should be unconditional in keeping the precepts and holding to the truth of the Dharma wherever we are and whoever we are with. It's that simple. The guest is Buddha nature, undivided, unborn, undying. Okay? Whatever name you want to give it. But it's not something we can grab or create. It's just there. It's always with us, this Buddha nature. And yet we're the ones who have to manifest it. And we do that in the choices that we make, or not, you know? Or we don't manifest it in the choices we make. If we act like a fool, we'll be a fool. Buddha nature isn't going to save us. We'll just be a fool, you know? If we act from Buddha nature, we'll just be ordinary. And yet, extraordinary, ordinary. In the Pali, there's a Buddhist term, and I hope I pronounce this right, Kalyamamita, okay? Kalyama means lovely or beautiful. Mita means friend. And actually, the lovely has a capital L. Lovely friend. And really what it is a descriptive name for the ultimate reality or the unconditioned Buddha nature, the unborn, the undying, whatever you want to call it. And Master Jiyu Kennett used to say, call it whatever you want, just find it. That's the thing. And this ultimate reality or unconditioned place, it's the place where we open the heart to see the loving kindness that embraces all things. In this place, we're not a self. We let go of self, and actually we let go of other, too. So in a sense, we transcend this proverb. And I think that's what the proverb is pointing to, is transcending the words. As we touch Buddha nature, we go in and out. Sometimes we practice alone. Sometimes we practice with others. Sometimes we make the Buddha smile, and sometimes I think he just shakes his head. Can't believe what we're up to. But, you know, if we're doing it correctly, it's just what is appropriate for things right as they are in front of us. So I found at the Hermitage that little things were important. We come here, one of the first things you learn is about straightening your shoes. Well, you know, I didn't have to be fanatical about straightening my shoes there, but there's something about straightening your shoes. It puts the mind in that place, in that kind of straightforward place. No one was going to trip on them. I don't think, you know, that the house is full of ants and spiders and wasps in and out. But there's something about straightening your shoes, okay? I found it important not to leave a mess with the project I was working on. You know, there was no one who was going to, you know, come and say, "What are you doing there?" You know, but it just kind of keeping things sort of orderly. It just helps our training, helps the mind. It's also it shows respect for those things. I'm not a very good housekeeper. The house was not spotless, but I found myself sweeping. You know, I had a friend growing up who said to me one day, he said, "What's the point in sweeping? It just comes back." And, you know, this guy was, he was kind of ahead of a lot of people at that time, but I thought, that's not right. There is a point in sweeping, even though it comes back. I think there's a point spiritually. So sweeping, vacuuming, all that, you know, it was a good thing to do. We have a nice small meditation hall there with a beautiful Buddha image. You know, see, I like to sit in one spot. Maybe that's attachment, I don't know, but I like a certain spot to sit in the room. So I would cross over the Buddha, you know. If I didn't bow, no one would notice, you know. But you don't want to do that. You know, there's just something in you. And also, you know, the kind of the quality of your bow. I mean, it's not a something that we compare, but we can be kind of, you know, curt and move on, you know, kind of, because nobody's watching, you know. What's the big deal? But I could find myself after doing that kind of saying, wait a minute, you know, and I just bow. And you know, I mean, you bow to your seat and you bow outwards. There's nobody across from you. But actually, when we sit in that place of Buddha nature, everything's sitting with us. Okay. Oh, when I was reciting the scriptures, I would find myself drifting. Yeah, what did I just say? Did I understand what I said? You know. So I had the opportunity where I could go back and recite it again, and I did that some of the time. Again, not fanatically, you know. But you know, it was a good opportunity. We can't do that here during morning service. You know, I mean, we wouldn't get through a scripture if we were kind of, you know, every time each one of us, you know, could raise our hand, row off, let's do that again. No, we can't quite do that. Okay. So we have this wonderful founder shrine out there. It was actually the person who gave us the property, Miriam King's practice room. She was a kind of Buddhist, Vedantist, you know, that's where she would practice. And it used to be you had to climb up this ladder to get in there. Well, now you can get in pretty directly. You just got to watch your head because it's a low entrance. But this really nice founder shrine, and I just, for some reason, I felt it was just really good to go there every day and thank Reverend Master Jiyu, who's the founder of that, because in Buddhism, it would be your teacher. So this Shasta Abbey, Reverend Master said, was founded by Koho Zenji, you know, although he'd never been here. But he's the one who passed the teaching on to her. So you could go to the founder shrine, I'd recite a small scripture and an offertory, and I think of Reverend Master, there's a lovely picture of her that's, you know, she had, I mean, it's like she's coming out of the picture looking at you. She had this way of meeting you eye to eye that was extraordinary. And there's also a picture of Miriam King in there. So we can thank her because it's a lovely gift, the Hermitage. And also to offer merit for her because I don't know where she is or what, you know, but just hope that her passing and what followed, you know, leads to a good way. Okay. So let me switch back to saying a few things about training with others. Training with others as if we are alone. Okay. You never lose your personal responsibility for your training, whether you train alone or you train with other people. I think it's a wonderful plus, an advantage to train with others. I wouldn't trade it for anything. We help each other immensely. If you, you know, some of us choose to have a teacher, it's not required and it's not necessary for everybody, but this also can be of a great help, this connection with people, a sangha. But even in these places of practice with others, we train alone. It's said that the Buddhas and ancestors point the way, we have to do the walking. They just point the way. They don't walk for us. Buddha nature is always with us. We are the ones who give expression to it. We have to do that or it doesn't shine through. If someone says, I can do it for you, I think I would be out the door. And that's always been my policy. I grew up in San Francisco, right near the Haight-Ashbury, you know, when I went to some events, and as soon as somebody said they could do it for you, I was on my knees and out of there. Because I just didn't want that, you know. Personal responsibility never leaves us. Each of us raises the will and willingness to train. Each of us receives the consequences of our choices. So I'm going to go back now to being alone at the Hermitage. It's a great opportunity to watch your mind. Weather permitting, I like to sit out in a meditation tent that we were given. It's something from Thailand, and it's kind of this open mesh that you can see out, and it's kind of a brown color, so I'm not sure how well critters can see in, okay? But you can definitely see out, and the breeze comes through it nicely and all that. It's out on our porch. Ajahn Chah, a Theravada master, said, try to be mindful and let things make their and take their natural course. Then your mind will become still in any surroundings, like a clear forest pool. All kinds of wonderful, rare animals will come to drink at the pool. And you will clearly see the nature of all things. You will see many strange and wonderful things come and go, but you will be still. This is the happiness of Buddha. Well, we don't quite have a pool there, but there actually is a fountain, and that draws critters to come through. The deer out there are pretty tame, unfortunately, and they'll come pretty close to you, but only so close. But I found when you're sitting in the tent, they'll go right by you. You know, they're 4 or 6 feet outside of the tent, and they don't appear to notice you, or maybe they pick up on the fact that you're still, and so there's nothing to be afraid of. And then the turkeys, who are usually very nervous, turkeys don't like to get too close. Again, 4 to 6 feet, they go by you, and they're pecking in the ground, and I don't know, maybe they have terrible eyesight or something, but they don't seem to notice you. Now, the squirrels are another matter. Back behind the house, you have this porch, and there's the tent there, and there's a draw. The land kind of comes, this little valley, little draw. In the wintertime, water flows down there, early spring. When I've been out there in the summertime, in the evening in particular, you hear this awful crashing going on. I mean, it's really loud. And, of course, the mind goes to, there's a bear coming. Because it, you know, this doesn't sound like anything small. It's a squirrel. I'm convinced it's a squirrel now. This is making this awful racket. There's no bear. And this time, also, I noticed, I kept hearing this small dog barking. And I thought, you know, what's going on? Is the neighbor, you know, one of the neighbor's dogs got on the property, or maybe somebody's gave us a dog. That's all we need. And then I figured, actually, it's the male turkey making this noise. Sound like a dog. Okay. So the hermitage is also the last house off the paved road before the road becomes a dirt road. And all this parallels Kidder Creek. So, you know, people go up the creek all the time. It's a beautiful creek. It's actually a river a lot of the year, the amount of water that flows through it. But sometimes in the night, vehicles are going up there. And it's hard to tell. You know, you just hear this sound of a car on the, you know, zooming along the paved road and then changing over to the gravel road. It's kind of hard to tell where they're going, and so the mind goes to where they're coming up the driveway. This is it, you know? And then you try to work out the scenario of what you're going to do when they come. You know, my mind came up with this one this time about, well, I'll just say, well, sheriff's coming any time. You might want to leave. It's just what your mind does. I mean, I think we all know our version of this, and you know, eventually, whether you're sitting or in bed, the mind just settles down. And it's like, oh, okay, well, if they come, they come, you know. It's just what it is. And they haven't come yet, so. So it's a good opportunity. I found that sitting out in nature to look at the imagination and the fear and the things that arise, and just, they arise, okay? You know, what basis do they have in reality, in the real world? Okay. One time when I was out there, it was in the summer. It was pretty warm. I had been outside reading, partly in the sun, and I got kind of drowsy. and started to fall asleep. So I went inside, and I was kind of half dazed, and I heard this knock on the door, and you don't get many knocks on the door out there. It's real kind of peculiar to have that. I was knocking on the door, and I opened the door, and there's this gentleman in fatigues. I'm thinking, okay. And then the next thing I know, he shows me his badge, and he's a sheriff. And he said, do you mind if we do a drug raid through your property? And I was really still half dazed, and I thought, well, okay, you know. And I looked outside, and there were a couple other vehicles. I think I must have let the gate open or something, but you know, so these vehicles could get in. That's probably why they came in this way. And I looked outside, and everybody was in their flap jackets, you know. And then they had machine guns, little machine guns. And I thought, whoa. So, in actual fact, the next day I went to Wairika because I needed to go there for something anyway. And I went to the sheriff's office and I said, did this really happen? Because I just couldn't quite, you know. And they said, oh yeah, we didn't find anything, you know. I mean, our neighbor had set up a watering system and had been hauling up 50-gallon barrels and water pipe, and, you know, it looked like maybe a meth lab or something was going to happen up there. But it was nothing. So there you go. Okay. So let me just end by saying that I think it's unconditional, consistent practice. We go in and out, you know. You know, practice is sometimes different depending on our circumstances. But it's that unconditional, consistent practice of the heart that's the key to unshakable peace. As we know, we cannot control circumstances. Peace of mind is not fixed to a quiet place. Quiet places are often not quiet. It's the mind. The Dharma is ever present, and we can give expression to it. Right now, whoever we are, wherever we are. This is the teaching of the Buddha. Our Master Kodo told a lovely story yesterday, I gather, at the Dharma class about Reverend Master Jiyu, who had this way of, you know, encouraging people in their practice. And Reverend Master Jiyu was doing a class in Berkeley at the time, and a woman said to her, well, I have 5 children. You know, it's very difficult to find time to practice. And what Reverend Master said to her, she said, well, do you have 10 minutes? Or, no, excuse me, what she said, could you sit on the edge of your bed for a few minutes before you get going in the day? That's, you know, that's meditation. And quite frankly, if you're raising 5 children and doing it with enthusiasm and effort and care, you're meditating. My sister had 8 children, and she used to say the only free time she had was the 10 minutes in the shower at night, you know, by herself. She says, it's a very monastic life. But you know, we don't have to look for some perfect situation so that we then will be able to train. When we're alone, great opportunity. You know, we can really work on certain aspects. We also can get stuck. There's been many, many great Buddhist teachers who got stuck on being alone. And then they would come back to people and leave the people shortly and just be shaking their head and saying, you know, these people, they're impatient, they're angry, they're this, they're that. And then they reflected and they said, well, actually, it's me. It's me who has these problems. So, you know, alone is wonderful sometimes, and practicing with others is good practice. The important thing is the stillness in the heart in all those places, because it's not different. It's not divided. Okay, thank you.